Okay, before we do open lines next hour, we're going to take your phone calls this hour with Rettman Mullis as we talk about Bigfoot. So we will go right to the calls. I'm going to chat with them a little bit about the language of these creatures when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Rettman, tell us a little bit more about the language of Bigfoot.
Sure. Yeah. Before I do that real fast, I just went ahead and posted that update for Dr. Ed Fuchs at Bigfootology.com, so okay. People can go up there. When you go to that website, there's a lot of different links there, but it's eventually going to be a like Bigfootology 101 if you want to go and learn all about the species, that type of thing. All that information will be there, but it's a slow process. But if you go to Bigfootology Field Reports, there's a whole series of articles there that talk about a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, even tonight. And so I invite people to go there and check that out. Also, you also hear me talk about a lot of the people on our team. And I just want to let it be known that, you know, we can't do this without the global effort of everybody involved, whether that's the novices on their team that are there for a purpose, as well as all the scientists that we have on our team. Because it takes that mastermind principle in order to solve these problems, including communication, the idea of how they communicate and why they communicate, that type of thing. And it's actually something I've been playing with for quite a long time. And we have people like Greg Roberts and Becky Creasy Rice who are helping us come to some conclusions about communication. And then, there's, of course, there's the brilliant Paul Graves, who knows how to do sound analysis. So he can take the sound of a Bigfoot in the woods and say, okay, that's within so many hertz, so that's definitely a Bigfoot versus a coyote. So there's a lot of talented people out there that are doing this. So this is why science constantly evolves. So what we give out are hypotheses, and as more evidence comes in, our hypotheses form conclusions that are reasonable based off the evidence. So in terms of communication, we know that they have many different forms of communication. We have tree knocks, we have rock clacking, we have whistles, we have the various types of screams, we have the actual language. And over the years, I've put out some ideas, and we're still working on the validity of some of these ideas, but I'll just show you what I have so far. And that is, we know that they do not travel single file through the woods. They travel a brief distance away parallel, and that way they don't leave any significant trails. So what they do when they're doing that is they'll whistle back and forth, because a whistle will carry through the woods easier frequency-wise than, say, talking. Okay? But when they're close together, they're going to talk. When they're intermingling with each other, they talk. We see that especially in the Sierra sounds, which is great footage, by the way. If you ever get a chance to buy those CDs I just brain farted his name, Ron Roy. But if you give a chance to buy the Sierra sounds, it's great stuff because it shows all the different ways they communicate. So when you hear the whistle sounds, it's usually because they're trying to locate each other in the woods very closely. Now, tree knocks, that actually travels farther through the woods than, say, a whistle does. Just like a rock clack will travel farther and sounds more normal, it would bring less suspicion to them being there. Becky Creasy Rice, who's from the Olympic Peninsula, tells a great story about how they would locate each other with tree knocks. And she goes, oh, there's one, there's another, and there's another on her property that she used to manage. So they know they use different things. For a long time, I always equated their night calls, their screams, with just locator sounds deeper in the woods, because they need to have more vocalization. They need to have that sound travel farther, because they don't know exactly who they're trying to reach and how far away they are. So that's when they go with the extreme vocalizations, the extreme screams, to say, hey, similar to what coyotes do, I'm over here, where are you? And when you get into the deep woods, you start hearing those type of screams. Sometimes you hear coyotes and dogs also howling along with those, you know, because it's a very similar call. Yeah. But again, you can record those calls, put it through a analyzer, and tell by the frequency, is that a coyote, is that a dog, is that a Bigfoot? Very fascinating stuff.
Now when they talk to each other, can it be interpreted? I mean, if we were able to get massive recordings of them and basically have experts in language study them, would they be able to decipher what they were saying?
there are actually some people who are trying to do that, and I've been following that just briefly. But they're, again, they're equating a lot of what they're saying to some kind of Asiatic language, you know, some form of Manchurian or whatever it is. But it's like it's a culmination. But a lot of the what they're able to pick out automatically is more of the dialect as opposed to word meaning. And so they're able to say, well, this definitely sounds like it's an Asian dialect of some type, which would give credence to the idea that somebody has about them actually prehistorically coming across, just like the humans did, across the land bridge through Alaska and the Bering Bridge or whatever it was called back then. But so they came along with a lot of other animals, and that's why they think that the language orientation is from the Orient. So, and again, there's a lot of smarter people than I am, definitely, in terms of language and communications that are actually working on this. And I think they will. Matter of fact, there are some people that have caught some of their language and have even claimed that there were some different Native American variations within that language. So it could be a compilation language or a language they developed all their own, but has been adapted from various encounters with different populations, whether it's Asiatic or Native American or what have you.
All right, let's take some calls for you here, Rettman. Let's go to Mark in Los Angeles to get us started. Hi, Mark, go ahead.
Hi. Well, just not to burst a bubble, I used to work in the makeup effects film industry, and there has been a running joke for a long time about the Patterson footage. You might want to do some research on two makeup artists by the name of John Chambers and Thomas Berman. John Chambers was noted for doing the makeup for the movie Planet of the Apes, won an honorary Oscar. One of his interns was a gentleman by the name of Thomas Berman. And it was well noted that John Chambers was the one who actually did the Patterson suit, that Tom Berman was more than likely in the suit. This has been a running joke that has floated around for years in the makeup effects community.
And yeah, that's why they call it a running joke, because it actually is a joke. So have you ever seen the first-generation footage of that film?
Yes, I have.
And where did you see it at, if I may ask?
I've had it basically floated around shops.
Because the only person that has access to that footage is two specific people, and that's up here in the Northwest.
Okay,
so
well,
I doubt that you're giving the total honest truth there, my friend.
Well, the total honest truth is that if you want to talk to guys like Rick Baker, you guys want to talk to any of the guys in the makeup effects industry, it's been running around for years. It's rather comical that it's still perpetuated as legitimate.
Right. Whereas we also have plenty of documentation from Academy Award-winning suit makers and stuff like that that say that's impossible, especially in that era of time. So this is one of those things where you get to believe whatever it is that you want to believe.
Sure.
Isn't that great? This is America.
That's what it comes down to. That's what it comes down to indeed. Okay, Mark, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Farlin in Ida, Oklahoma. Hey, Farlin, go ahead.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yes, Bigfoot language was basically the first thing that happened to me on my first encounter back in 2004. So I'm just intrigued by it all. And when I finally later got to hear the Sierra sounds, it just validated everything for me. It sounded just like that samurai chatter. And I was wondering what your guest thinks about Scott Nelson's research on the Sierra sounds recordings. He's breaking it down where he's a retired cryptolinguist from the Navy. So he's got a computer program that's broken it down to where he can identify the sentences and the words. He can't tell you what the words mean, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also hearing some English mixed in, which to me makes total sense, because everyone in America has been speaking English for at least the last 100 years. It would only make sense that they would incorporate some English into their language by now, to me. But I was just wondering what your take was on that.
No, I completely agree, and I think that's actually who I was talking about, even though I couldn't remember the names of the people. But, there are some, again, like I said, people smarter than I am when it comes to this language stuff that are doing great research, and we're waiting for those outcomes as well, and there are some good conclusions. Still, what does it all mean? We don't know. That's why I always point to Bob Chukowski's work, because he's actually sat down and has able to determine what some words mean, including the names, because those specific words keep coming up. Again, if anybody has the opportunity, go to SasquatchSounds.com. That's Bob Trukowski's site. And he's got evidence of apple bites, so it'll show how big the bites are. There's great stuff down there out of Texas. But, you know, let me ask your phone caller there. Have you heard anything about this mind-speak phenomenon?
He is now gone.
So oh, okay. Sorry about that. So, yeah, I was going to actually mention the mind-speak phenomenon. That seems to be something growing right now within the Bigfoot community. And I actually have a theory about that as well. Again, all it is all we have is mostly theory, okay? And, again, the theory is based off of, you know, hundreds and even thousands of different anecdotal evidences and DNA and a lot of other stuff. But, you know, again, when it comes down to it, is it all theory? But there's a growing concern or phenomena within the Bigfoot community where they're talking about mind speak. They can hear the Bigfoot speaking to them in their head. And my problem with that is, okay, they speak English to you? And then they say, well, it's a universal language. And I start going, oh, okay, that gets a little deep in here. I need to get my waders on. Okay, but there is something going on that I do believe could possibly explain this. And this is the use of infrasound. If you ever sit around elephants, their heads are so large, and they communicate infrasound through large structures, concrete walls, and stuff like that, with other elephants. And when you're standing there, you can actually feel the vibration in the air of them communicating infrasound. So a lot of their language, we don't ever even hear because it's beyond our frequency range. Now, we also know that before an earthquake hits, you have all these animals reacting before the earthquake even shakes the ground. And that's because they're reacting to the infrasound that occurs before that tremor occurs. And so that tells us that there are many different animals in the world that have the ability to communicate infrasound, which means that most of the actual communication that occurs within most species, we humans never even hear. Why does my little dog know that there's a cat across the street or a dog across the street when there's never a sound? But she knows because they may be communicating infrasound-wise. So my thinking is, as humans grow older, we lose certain sensitivities. We lose the ability to see certain frequencies, hear certain frequencies, that type of thing. And maybe some of these folks still have a degree of sensitivity in terms of being able to understand and hear infrasound themselves. So maybe that's what they're hearing. Bigfoot has obviously the capability of doing communications beyond our range because he's an apex predator. So it's a reasonable assumption to say that they are using infrasound like other animals do. And maybe that's what these people that are experiencing mind speak are experiencing in terms of it's not actually hearing languages, but they're hearing whatever it is that Bigfoot's communicating to them via that ability.
Tell us about the Oak Harbor Bigfoot story, Redmond.
Okay, that was fun. I don't remember exactly what time it was. It was like maybe 1:30 in the morning, whatever it was. And I get a phone call saying, you need to get over here now. I was living in North Oak Harbor, and it's not a very far distance, maybe about a mile and a half. And you go into the east area, you got like base housing down there, a lot of farmland. And by the time we got back, we were called up to say, hey, there's something going on down here. There's a screamer down here. And so we went down, got in our vehicle, went down, pitch black, middle of the night. And this is Oak Harbor. We roll up the streets after 5 o'clock here. Nobody goes anywhere. Nobody does anything. And at that point in the morning, it seemed like everybody and their dog was out driving around trying to figure out what in the world was going on. So the next day, me and my team, we get in our vehicles and we head down and we look at the different forest areas. Where could these things have been standing, screaming across this valley? And we took into consideration, echo and how the sound would cover. And our first spot, we were wrong. Nothing, there was no signs. So we went over to the other side of the valley near Taylor Road, and we went up to this guy's mobile home. And we knocked on the door and says, hey, did you hear anything last night? And the guy goes, yeah, let me tell you what happened. And I actually just found the video, the I need to figure out how to get cassette over to CD, because I actually have the whole interview. I just found it recently. Okay. But he talked about how the guy across the road on the other side of Taylor Road was threatening to trap all these coyotes, a very older man. And he thought maybe this night that he had finally done it, because there was something screaming. And so he grabbed this big metal flashlight, and he did turn it on because he, you know, that's his home. He knows the road. And he walked up the gravel road to Taylor Road, which is his driveway, and followed the sound. And he walked across the road into this older gentleman's kind of a circular driveway. In the middle of that circular driveway is a little garden area and some tall trees, some grass. And he walked up to where that garden spot was, which is like had a, like a 4-foot fence around it. Mm-hmm. And he's listening to this thing, almost like a replay of what happened to me down in 98 at Admiral's Cove outside my house, where you're literally feeling the breeze from this thing screaming, but you can't see them because it's so dark. And in his case, he reached up to click on the flashlight, and as soon as he clicked on the flashlight, it went dead. The noise went quiet. And he was scared, and he said he stood there for a few minutes, and then he left. Well, after that interview, we'd retraced his footsteps. We went back across the road, and on the south end of that circular driveway, in the south part of that driveway, there is like a 4, maybe 4.5, maybe 5-foot fence there. And the grass on the other side was just as tall as that fence was. And immediately what stepped out was there was a footprint on one side of that driveway. It was all gravel. A footprint on the other side of the driveway next to that fence, and then a set of footprints on the other side of that fence that angled back up into the woods where we always thought they may have been. There was a ravine further east of there. Very blatant footprints, nicely fanned out, wonderful, wonderful. So we went back the other way, crossed the driveway, and went around that garden area. Massive sit-down areas, flat grass, plenty of foot track areas. Went back farther up into the circular driveway in the deeper wood area. And the most amazing thing was there were two adults that had sat down next to each other, and they crushed the grass in such a way that there were even single 3.5-foot tall blades, you know, forming this perfectly circular pattern where they basically backed back. Fascinating. We trailed, and then we tracked them across the driveway on the north side, under the awning where the house splits from the garage, back into their backyard over there, and then back up into the woods. So they basically did this big U, got to the garden area, started their scream, which alerted everybody in the valley that they were there, and then after they got interrupted by this guy with the flashlight, that's when he left, and they stepped over the driveway, over the fence, and then back up into the woods. And very fascinating stuff.
That's a great story. Hey, we're going to come back and take some final calls with you, Rhett, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you get up to our website, coasttocoastam.com, you'll see our Insta poll on Bigfoot. Pretty amazing results, and you can still vote. We're going to keep that up there for you all night long. Go to the coasttocoastam.com website under the highlights reel, the Insta poll. You can click that and vote. By the way, I will be in Philadelphia tomorrow at a ghost hunt. Information there also on our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, we will begin our open lines. When we come back, more phone calls with Rhettman Mullis as we talk about Bigfoot on Coast to Coast AM. Back to more calls. Carl is in Orlando. Carl, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hey. Hi, Redmond. It's very nice to meet you. George, hi.
Hi there, Carl.
Oh, I got a story to tell you guys, man. This is unbelievable for me.
Okay.
For years, I've been trying to get it out and don't know, and kind of leery about it because it's kind of off the wall. But when I was 16, I lived in a resort called Bermuda Ranch between Everglades City, Florida, and Naples, Florida. It's right on the Tamiami Trail. And one night I came home late. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And right at the Bermuda, there was a place where they used to mow the lawn. And there was the Everglades, and then they mowed like a section out where you from the Everglades where you could see. And I got off late, and I was walking down the road, and at the corner of my eye, I saw this black shape and I couldn't figure out what it was. And I ran like the wind at that time. I'm getting excited about this. I'm sorry, guys. Mm-hmm. But, I ran like a crazy person, about 400 or 500 yards, and turned around to see where this thing was at. And I thought it would be behind me. Well, anyway, it had followed me all the way up, and it was parallel to me right at that section.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I freaked out, of course, and didn't know what to do. And I knew a lot about animal behavior from watching like Lance Link and the Secret Chimps. I don't know if you remember that or not. But I acted like a monkey and jumped up and down like a crazy monkey and screamed at it and chucked mm-hmm. hand at it and all kinds of stuff.
And, yeah, which you would have experienced is what they call a skunk ape down in Florida. They're actually a little bit shorter than our Pacific Northwest counterparts. They usually average, 6 to 7 feet down there. But yeah, very, very standard behavior, and that's tracking somebody alongside as they stay in the woods.
No, Raymond, this gets better yet, okay?
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I didn't know what it was, okay? So the very next day I got up, and I'm walking back down the road to school to catch the bus. It had to go down that same road. And that very exact same spot, all the maintenance men were there. And I said, what's going on? And they said, oh, nothing. And I looked down, and there was a Florida panther dead, okay?
Wow.
And its front legs had been ripped out.
Wow.
Like pulled apart, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I got on the bus, and I knew the Seminole Indian kids, and I asked this Seminole Indian kid, hey, what could kill a panther? What do you think happened? I told him the whole story. And he said, skunk ape, the skunk apes. I called the skunk apes.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to my aid, and they saved mm-hmm. my life.
Yeah, skunk apes are also called Shawanakis down there. I helped Ronnie Roseman. He had produced a video with Peter Byrne called Shawanaki, Florida Skunk Ape. Or Florida's Shawanaki, the Skunk Ape, Florida's Bigfoot. Great little documentary if you ever get a chance to pick that up. But yeah, standard typical behavior, breaking legs. Was there any other type of damage to the leopard? Was it maybe a defensive kill, or was it a food kill?
Beaten to death, I'm telling you.
Torn apart.
It was torn apart, drugged all over the place, blood everywhere. It was unbelievable.
Wow, that's incredible. That's cool.
Do the Bigfoot, do they eat meat?
Yes, they're omnivorous. They're a what I call an opportunistic eater. When I coach people to go out and have experiences, I tell them you need to follow the food. Where are the berries blooming? Where are the apples blooming? Where are the salmon running? Where are the deer at this time of year? Are they up in the woods or up down in the valleys? And you learn to follow those things, and you have a greater opportunity to encounter a Bigfoot because they know where the food is in their area, and they know what they need, whether it's protein or, berries or what have you. Mushrooms are... Our guy, Tim Olson, out of Northern California, documents a great story about a woman who came across a Bigfoot family, a male, female, and a child, that were grazing on mushrooms, So you just have to know where the food is and then stay there or watch there or be somewhere close by where you can observe, and you'll eventually see them come up because they have to eat. Very large animal. In terms of kills, deer kills, broken legs, even up here in the North Cascades area, we have llama and lambs and cows that have their hind legs ripped off. Nothing in the world can do that. Coyotes, bears, nothing can do that. So what else can do it? Well, Bigfoot's known for doing that. And so we have all these carcasses with things ripped off and missing, or legs broken, or midsections pulled out with the missing of certain organs like livers. But all of that is just indications that they eat a lot of different things. We've seen them steal salmon hauls from shipping vessels. We've seen them go into backyards and take all the apples off of trees when they bloom, and even off the ground. They're very opportunistic eater, even to the point where they will scavenge people's garbage. Duval, East King County, very near the city. There were constant Bigfoot sightings of this one nursing home where the Bigfoot was coming in and stealing out of their food, their trash bins, sure, where the food was thrown away from the day.
I remember I had a call. You tell me if you think this was a real call or not, because I don't know. But the person said that when he was smaller, he was catching fish near a stream, and he caught two of them, and that there was a Bigfoot right next to him staring at him, and he was petrified, and he was like 5 feet away from it. So he handed the two fish to the Bigfoot, and the Bigfoot took them and then looked at him and gave him one back. Now, does that sound real?
That's actually quite a common story. As a matter of fact, there's a similar story of that on the Lummi Reservation that was shared to me even just as last year. Very common story. Matter of fact, there have been plenty of anecdotal evidence where there'll be a net over a stream where they're catching salmon. The fishermen will come up, and from a distance they can see a female with a child, and the female is taking the salmon out of this net, take three for herself but leave two there. There was another similar story where a Bigfoot was seen taking chickens out of a chicken coop and would kill each one and then lay it in line with each other, take three and leave two. Whether it's three or two, that's just probably a coincidence. But there's a lot of stories like that, including, again, up on the Lummi, where the Lummi are a fishing reservation, where they're constantly being stalked by, especially on the Delta there, Bigfoot will sit there, and some of them will actually catch a fish, throw one to the Bigfoot, they'll go off, and they'll continue fishing. It's a very common story.
I love that story. Let's go to Brandon in Pittsfield, Maine, first-time caller. Brandon, go ahead.
Hi, I just had a question. Do the Bigfoots do anything special with their dead? And I'll take my question off the air.
All right. Do they do anything with their dead?
Yeah, there's... I actually didn't expect to get into this today, but I actually teach that they have a sociology, they have a spirituality, so on and so forth, because there's plenty of anecdotal evidence. And if you go to, again, Bigfootology.com, Ray Crow has a great article there called Where Are the Bones? And it goes into a lot of detail, tracking back significant history, all this anecdotal evidence about how they bury their dead, and they've been caught burying their dead. You know, I saw my first Bigfoot swimming in 77 from the peninsula over to Whidbey Island. It was in 1996 that we found right there where they tend to come ashore at, and we found plenty of tracks through there, including feces that we tried to get through Dr. Krantz. We found what we think are burial mounds right off the water. So not all of them, apparently, what we surmise is not all of them survived the swim. And so they would just bury their dead right there. We've never have been able to get back in there to actually do the excavations. And that's something we really want to do one day. But that's going to involve getting some anthropologists involved and stuff like that. So it's going to be a big project. But, again, there's plenty of other evidence out there where Bigfoot has been killed by the side of the road, whatever, hit by something, and the spouse or whatever, the mate, will take that Bigfoot and go off and bury it. Lots of stories like that. Matter of fact, it's actually one of the more common stories. So, yeah, they do bury their dead. They will stick around until it's safe to take their dead away.
We have seen the incredible strength of chimpanzees. You can only imagine the strength of a Bigfoot, Redman.
Oh, yeah, especially when you get up in the mountains and you start seeing these tree breaks and these tree bends. One thing I'm going to be posting here in the next week is the incredible shelter. The neatest shelter we ever found was brought to us by Stephen Fisher and Becky Rice out off the peninsula. Incredible. What they had to do to carry all these trees in to make this teepee structure and then hide it all in all these ferns. Amazing what they can do. And the incredible amount of strength that it takes, including snapping trees. Whenever we go up to the mountains, when we look at a tree break, we look, what did this first? Could have been rot, could have been snow, could have been a wind shear, and we get all those other things out of the way, and there's some things we just go, there's no excuse for this. Something took this tree that was 12 inches in circumference and just snapped it like it was a toothpick. Amazing stuff. We have a picture of that up on the Lummi when we took Igor Burtsev up there. Amazing how much strength they have.
Let's go to Denver, Colorado. Jim's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Jim, go ahead.
Hi, this is Jim D. from Denver, Colorado. Hi, George, how are you?
Good, Jim. Thank you.
Listen, Back in 1962, I lived in Detroit, Michigan, and on DeQuinder Avenue and 8 Mile Road, the old Belmont Shopping Center, they had a trailer there with a sign saying, come see the Abominable Snowman, Sasquatch, Yeti, but it didn't say Bigfoot at the time. For $3 a head, you could see a frozen body of a Bigfoot in like an open coffin.
That's talk about the Minnesota
I went in there and looked at it.
Yes, it was. You know, you're absolutely right. I was in Detroit at that time, too. I was 12, 13 years old. I had heard a story, may have been written in the Detroit News or Free Press, but you are right, Redman. That is that Minnesota Iceman story, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. Matter of fact, the interesting thing is Thomas Finley, our representative out of the UK, he's actually an American from Minnesota, and he lived in the town where that gentleman is from. And part of the things that we're having him do is drum up some of that old information so we can learn more about it and see what kind of legitimacy was there really in that. So we're actually, that's one of the behind, we have a lot of projects that we have going on behind the scenes and in the future, including highly sophisticated decoys with lots of technology involved. So when the funds permit tracking devices, when the funds permit, we're going to be able to afford to do those type of projects. You know, that's another thing too. If you go to Bigfootology.com, we are a nonprofit organization. We provide everything that we do for free because we believe in sharing information the world needs to know. We're a nonprofit organization for the benefit of science and education. That's why we don't charge for anything. So it could be helpful if we have some support from those in the Bigfoot community that want to help out. And so that would help out in producing some of these future projects that we need to do. So the other thing we do is we are not an exclusive organization. In other words, we have people on our team that we encourage them to be a part of other teams, to share information, to protect each other, to encourage each other. You know, when even our vice president, Greg Roberts, he belongs to the Southern Oregon Bigfoot. Tom Graham, he belongs to the State of Jefferson Sasquatch Research. All over Texas, Pennsylvania group we have now, we're looking for people out in Virginia. We are here to bring civility to the Bigfoot community, to bring legitimacy to the research that everybody's doing. And that's why we recognize these folks as recognized Bigfoot researchers, as legacy awards that go to long-term Bigfoot researchers like Lauren Green and Bob Gimlin and Ray Crow. We gave one to John Green last year. You know, or Lauren Coleman, I meant.
Lauren Coleman, yeah.
Yeah, Lauren Coleman. So we gave one to, you know, John Green last year at his memorial thing that we did. Not a memorial, it was an event to celebrate his years. So we have all of these things in the work, and it takes time, it takes money, and it's a lot of work, I'll tell you what. But what you know, answer to your question earlier, what drives us? It's fun. It's amazing. I've seen them twice. I've had literally more audio and other interactions over the years that I can't even count anymore. So when people go, that was the suit, I go, you know what? I never asked for any of this stuff. I never wanted any of this stuff.
No.
You know, and nobody knew, nobody thought, well, there's some bozo going out in the woods camping. Let's go ransack his camp, pretend we're Bigfoot. No, it's nothing like that ever happened. You know, so I have nothing to prove here or disprove here. So when I share these things, it's not about what's in it for me. I don't care. I enjoy it. It tweaks your mind. It gives you a lot of fun. And you meet a lot of wonderful people. There are a lot of great people. And we don't necessarily all agree. But, you know, we just enjoy each other's company. Pearl Perhoda does amazing history work. Scott White does amazing history work. Tom Cantrell, an incredible guy. He's just a lot of fun to be with, even though we don't agree on anything. You know, but there's just a lot. Steven Struffert, he gets on a lot of people's nerves, but you know what? This guy is smart, and some people would be better off listening to what this guy has to say half the time. You know, so that's what we try to do at Bigfootology. We say, you know what? We recognize, despite the fact that some people don't get along, some people don't believe the same thing, it's okay. Together, we'll all come up with the solutions, and we can have a good time in the process. A lot of good people. And that's what Ray Crow tried to do
with the Western Bigfoot Society meetings every month. He gave everybody a voice. He didn't care what you thought, what your history was. He let it up to the people who were listening to make up their own minds. He didn't judge them. He didn't accuse them. He just said, you know, share your story. Let's see what happens. And that's Ray Kroc's legacy. And that's really all we're trying to do at Bigfootology, saying, you know what? We're scientists. We're adding legitimacy, and we're respecting everybody as we try to do. That's why you don't see blur squatches and blob squatches on our sites. That's why you don't see us attacking people or demeaning people. And this is why we always say, you know what? If you're finding great evidence, good for you, because you're helping us bring this thing to a conclusion that says not only are they real, but this is what they are.
Well, good point. Let's see if we can squeeze Jim in from Denham Springs, Louisiana. We'll get you in real fast, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Oh, boy, I had so much to say. There's so much evidence out there about Bigfoot. It's unbelievable. I've been tracking them for 30 years. I go in central Louisiana. I find four-toe Bigfoot prints where there's three Bigfoot prints in a row on the side of the bayou, and they all have four toes, left, right, left. It said its baby in the mud. It had four toes also.
Mm-hmm.
My present wife, when she in the 80s, she was on the Arkansas and the Ouachita Mountains. She's actually been tracked by a couple of days by a Bigfoot while she was having her menstrual cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And during the tent at night while they were sleeping, it reached through the tent and grabbed her head.
Mm-hmm.
She felt a hand grab her head on top of the tent, through the tent, and grabbed the top of her head. My son and my ex-wife have seen one in Minnesota just trucking across the field.
Mm-hmm.
My wife was a young girl in South Louisiana. They had a panther come through the woods, and the next thing you know, right behind the panther, there's all these screams coming from the woods, Bigfoot screams,
mm-hmm.
and the trees are shaking, and the grandmother, who was Cherokee, was screaming, it's the devils are out there, it's the devil, let's go home, it's the devils out there. And that's what this Cherokee called the Bigfoot, was the devils. And there's just so many stories about this, you know, really happening out there. And four toes, is that a different species or what?
Well, it's got to be. We're at the top of the hour. Open lines next. Rettman Mullis, keep in touch with us. We want to know about Dr. Brian Sykes' DNA work, and we shall be right back.